From the miles of my nautical heart and the heart of my dog's nudicles, you're listening to Dave's Gone By.
There goes the Daverhood.
You got David Lefkowitz here. He's a Long Island arts guy. He's got his own radio show.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the 318th edition of Dave's Gone By, a little show that I've been doing first on the radio and now on the internet for 7 years. You know, for the past bunch of weeks, I've been saying 6.5 years that we've been doing this talk and comedy and music program, but looked at the calendar and realized that on October 6th, we passed the last milestone. So we are now a 7-year-old program, and a program with 317 episodes previously behind it. But this is a brand new one here on this Sunday afternoon, October 18th, 2009, and we're calling this one Soda Pop, because even though I'm ensconced back in my new home in northern Colorado, and I'm actually going back to New York for a week next week, in between there somewhere, I managed to escape the somewhat cold fall weather and get over to the southwestern side of Florida for a theater and arts festival there, and also just to see the sights and look around and soak in the water, which, considering the humidity of the air, was actually in the air already. There's really no need to have oceans and bays and the Bay of Mexico out in Florida over there. Basically, the air is so wet, you're already breathing the ocean every time you take a sniff or you inhale. So it was, well, I'll tell you all about the Florida trip in just a few minutes, but let me tell you what it's going to be on this show as a whole. Besides that, well, also going to tell you some inside Broadway stuff. That's a segment we do every week on Dave's Gone By, where we tell you all the big news and gossip that's going on the Great White Way in New York, and I'll also be reviewing some of the shows that I got to see when I was down in Florida. And if there's time on this episode, we're bringing back a segment called The World Weird Web, and that is where I look all over the internet for interesting, crazy, and fun things to share with you, where you can just kind of drop in the URL and take a look for yourselves. Should be kind of fun on the World Weird Web. So that's what we do on Dave's Gone By and have been doing for, lo, these 7 years. And hi, these 7 years. I'm Dave Lefkowitz, by the way, radio personality, theater critic, arts festival critic in this particular episode, and also the very, very grateful recipient of sponsorship for this program from some great folks at Hewlett Minuteman Press, the copy kings of Broadway. Since the mid-1970s, the Toron family has owned and operated Hewlett Minuteman Press right on Broadway in Hewlett, and they do great work at good prices. Not only that, if you tell them Dave sent you, you get 10% off any job, big or small, at Minuteman in Hewlett. Just give them a buzz, 516-569-5577. That's 516-569-5577, Hewlett Minuteman Press. They are the kings of copies. This program is also brought to you by Fancy Schmancy Balloons, owned and operated by someone you might know well if you've listened to this show for a while, Jeff Goodman, out on Long Island and making your party look as great as it possibly can. I know the title, the name of his company can be kind of misleading. You think it's just about balloons, or he stands there making balloon animals, but it's nothing of the sort. What Fancy Schmancy Balloons does is take a drab party that looks like nothing and really makes it look like a cool party with balloons and balloon archways and centerpieces for your table. So let's say you have a theme. You want your bar mitzvah to be reminiscent of Seinfeld or the New York Yankees. That's what Jeff does, and he makes it look absolutely marvelous. Plus, if you're planning a party from scratch and you really don't even know what to do as far as a DJ or catering or any kind of music or just even where to do it, Jeff is the one-man party plan and do. So give him a call at 516-797-3229. 516-797-3229. Shouldn't your party be a fancy schmancy event? And finally, this program is brought to you by Performing Arts Insider Theater Magazine. It's been the Bible of Broadway since 1944. This is the journal, this is the magazine where the people who are in the entertainment industry go to find out what is happening every day on the stages of New York. Broadway, off-Broadway, cabaret, opera, dance. Anything you need to know, it's in there, from the date that a show may be opening months from now on Broadway to rumors of shows that may be coming in 2 or 3 years from now. Plus, you want to find out how to contact an actor or a designer or the producers of a show. Maybe you have an idea for a show yourself and you want to find backing. This is the place to go, Performing Arts Insider. Please go to performingartsinsider.com and also check my website, davesgoneby.org, to find out how you, as a Dave's Gone By listener, can get an amazing subscription rate on Performing Arts Insider. And by the way, davesgoneby.org is the place to go to find out everything about this program. Yeah, you can see pictures, and you can see the websites of all the famous guests that we've had on the show, and also you can listen to nearly every episode that we have ever done. That's, as I said, that's about 317 so far, and they're all absolutely free. You can put them on your iPod, or you can listen to them just streaming right on your computer. Check it out in the archive section of davesgoneby.org. Well, don't want to take up any more time with preview stuff. Going to jump right into the ocean, or I guess it's actually the Bay of Mexico there, as we head off to Sarasota and environs, Florida, which I'll be back to talk about right after.
Minuteman, the superheroes of photocopying, printing and binding. Minuteman, no job too big or small. Minuteman, family run since 1975. Minuteman, 1315 Broadway in Hewlett, Long Island, next to the new Lowman's shoe store. Tell them they've sent you for 10% off. Minuteman, hero of our photocopying dreams.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. Come travel with me. I realize you just got here. You just tuned into the neighborhood a few minutes ago. But pack your bags, or at least the bags under your eyes, and join me as I recount the details of my trip last week to sunny Florida. And by sunny, I am understating the case. I've been living in Colorado for 2 months now, and we have a lot of sun here. It's one of the things that brings tourists to town and residents to stay. But I had forgotten what humidity was like. Funny how you forget the nasty things a lot quicker sometimes than the pleasant things in life. Like a woman giving birth will go through excruciating pain during labor, screaming and cursing and denouncing the father of her fetus. Soon as the kid pops out, the mom is all, "Oh, let me hold him, oh, he's so adorable. We're going to make you a baby brother, aren't we, Papa?" Agony forgotten. You go to the dentist. You sit there in waves of woe. And an hour later, you're scarfing down Oreos. So it's the same with heat and hot weather. My wife and I moved from New York in the middle of August, the kind of weather where you are showering twice a day just because you're afraid to stand near anybody if you don't. Well, it's summer in northern Colorado, and that's just the same as it is on Long Island. And when we came out here, we expected and received a lot of sunny days also. Bright, bright sunshine, with my wife slathering on the SPF 50 every time she poked her head out the door. If there was an SPF 112, she would have used it. But for the most part, even on those hot, hot days in mid-August, it wasn't too uncomfortable because it is a dry climate here. All that stuff they used to tell us about is not the heat, it's the humidity. Well, it's actually true. I mean, if you're in Las Vegas and it's 103 degrees, it is the heat. But 95 in Colorado is like 85 in New York. Not quite comfortable, not something you want to be out in for a long time, but you don't wilt. You can't fry an egg on the sidewalk, but you can poach one. So spending the late summer in Colorado was, in a lot of ways, more agreeable than doing the dog days back on the East Coast. But autumn comes pretty quickly here. The weather, well, anyone who knows Colorado knows, you don't get change of season. You get change of afternoons. It can be 40 degrees when you wake up, 80 degrees at 1 p.m., and a lightning storm can pass through before midnight. And that is no exaggeration. I have seen it happen. So last week, after relentlessly gorgeous weather up here at the foot of the Rockies, fall made its presence felt. And it's like someone opened the door and let all the hot out. And suddenly, it went straight from shorts and a t-shirt to a winter coat and scarf. No in-between of corduroy and a Mr. Rogers sweater. No, hello, Jack Frost. But, okay, that's the trade-off. It's God saying, you want the nice, gorgeous weather for a few weeks? No problem. But I'm also going to throw some misery at you. Well, not misery, but just that feeling that not only is summer over, but winter's much closer than you think, and it won't be until March that you feel like a person again. So, just when this was happening weather-wise in Colorado, I was lucky enough to be invited to Florida to partake in a theater festival down there. Brand new arts festival put on by the Ringling people. Sarasota was the home base of the circus and John Ringling, who basically made his whole compound there, kind of a Donald Trump of his day. And so the folks marketing the Ringling Arts Festival were kind enough to invite me and some other journalists down to check it out. And I thought, perfect. What could be nicer than bugging out of Colorado in October and spending a few days in Florida, especially with the first cold front hitting here. And there I was, packing my bathing suit, my shorts, my blank logo-less baseball cap. But as I said, what I had forgotten about was that Florida doesn't just have heat. It's got heat with wet. So I'm stepping off the airplane in Sarasota on an autumn Tuesday afternoon. And you know how you can feel the outside world before you even exit the airport? Because in that stretch between walking off the plane and into the lobby, you're only tenuously connected by a walkway. And whatever temperature the airport is, whatever climate control they piped in from Acme Air, that walkway is the outside temperature. So, I swear to God, the first thing that goes through my mind as I'm hoofing it out of the renewed post-bankrupt Frontier Airlines is, so that's what humidity feels like. It don't feel very good. It feels like you're breathing tea. But everything else about that stretch of Florida feels very nice indeed. I don't know, maybe they did feel the recession down there, but you go along those keys and you wouldn't know it. Not the eastern keys, Key Largo, Key West, those are on the other side. These are on the west. There's St. Armand's Key and Lido Key, and I was staying on Longboat Key. And I was told that, yes, the recession hit hard here for a lot of people, and the middle and lower classes were just getting killed. But you pass all these boutiques and shops and house after house right by the water, and somebody's making money in America. Not me, but somebody. And I did ask, because so many of the beach houses down there are rentals, and every stretch, half the houses had for rent signs up, one after the other. And I said, wow, I guess the vacation trade really took a hit when the market kicked. And I was told, oh, no, no, most of these rental houses are owned by people so rich, they don't really care whether they're rented out or not. It's just extra income, which is another great reason to hate the rich. Not that I needed another, but, you know, it's always good to have more ammunition when the revolution comes, 100 years after my lifetime. Oh, and I did want to give a shout-out to Lamar, the guy who picked me up at the airport. Great dude, wonderful attitude, telling me all about his life in Florida and why he would choose it over most anywhere else, especially the Northeast. Lamar is a black man, not a Rasta, but he had the Rasta hair, and he had that typical outlook that Southerners have. Loves the heat, and anything below 60 degrees makes him shiver. I remember him telling me he was staying somewhere, and one day he woke up, went outside, and it was 58 degrees, and he was freezing, and he couldn't wait to get back out. Well, meanwhile, I had just left the place with snow flurries and our first under 30 degree night, and I was like, oh, you poor thing, you were shivering at 58, I'm so glad it didn't go down to 56 and give you frostbite. Happily, Lamar is used to passengers who drip with sarcasm and didn't kick me out of the car or even hold it against me. As a matter of fact, we had one of those conversations that could only happen among strangers in a new place with nothing to lose by sharing secrets. We were talking about spicy food. I was asking about restaurants to eat in around Longboat Key and Greater Sarasota, and he said he wasn't really that up on local cuisine because he has a pretty careful diet, and especially he stays away from spicy food. So we had a typical conversation about health and losing weight and all that. He tells me he lost about 70 pounds because of his new regimen. You never know, this guy was once obese, never. And God bless him, I asked him why he avoided spicy food, and suddenly we were on the topic of anal fissures. Not everybody would admit something like that. Most people would hedge. Why don't you like spicy food? Doesn't agree with me. I have a family history of high blood pressure. It keeps me up at night. Not Lamar. Here we are. I've known the man for 20 minutes, and he's telling me, oh, it was terrible. I had this problem in my anus, and the doctor gave me a choice. He said, you can either have surgery, which comes with its own complications, or you can try to do it natural through diet and medicine, but it'll take a year to heal. Well, for better or worse, Lamar chose the holistic method. The butt-holistic method, sorry. And I'll never forget him holding up his index finger and saying, every day I have to put the cream on. Which immediately sent me trying to remember which hand I shook when I first met him at the airport. But, hey, Lamar stuck to his diet, he stuck to his ointment, or the ointment stuck to him, and it took a full year, but he is fine now. He lost all that weight, and Lamar is no longer the Fisher King. But I digress. We get to the hotel on Longboat Key. It's the Hilton, which is not tremendously fancy, but it's more than fancy enough for the likes of me. I was given a suite, which was sweet, and even though it's stupid little nonsense, I come in, and there's cheese and crackers and a fruit plate in the fridge. It's nice to be greeted by something like that, especially since I had not eaten a real meal since that morning. I had flown on Frontier Airlines, as I mentioned, which has really comfortable seats, but not a speck of free food. I mean, they don't even give you a peanut, not a pretzel, not even a crumb of an Otis Spunkmeyer oatmeal raisin whatchamacallit. You get beverages, and you can buy a sandwich, but Jesus, people, a one-ounce bag of nuts, would that really put you back in bankruptcy? But as I said, I'll say this for Frontier, from front to back, the seats look like business class, not cushy first-class seats that recline far enough for a shiatsu massage, but still, if you've flown on Continental or United and you're used to sharing the buttock of the person to your right, it's definitely nice. Anyway, the Hilton Hotel in Longboat Key, Florida is very nice, very comfortable, and I have a little nosh there, and then it's time for dinner. And because I'm a journalist and a theater critic, that means you have to feed me constantly to keep me happy. Go to any press junket, ask any group of starving writers and editors, and we turn into Mr. Creosote. If we so much as smell something roasting or a baked good, we're on it like lions on a dead gazelle. But happily, that night was the first dinner with all the other journalists and the marketing people bringing us to see the festival. And we all had dinner at the Lido Beach Resort restaurant. Ooh, fancy schmancy, with a terrific view and not a bad rack of land, I might add. The best part is that I've been used to traveling with other theater journalists. I belong to the American Theater Critics Association. I'm in the drama desk. So usually, we're just gorging for the sake of eating, but really there to see the theater. This time, I was with mostly travel writers and food writers. So every time a dish would come to the table, we would all stop. The person would get up, get the camera, and start taking pictures of the meal. Now these are not, I assume, food critics, people who are going to write critically and subjectively about the dishes at these restaurants. Because you figure critics are going to be pretty discreet and incognito. Kind of hard to do that when the waiter brings your pasta and you jump up, grab the telephoto lens, and take 10 pictures of it. But hey, as one of our fellow journalists said, this is the new media, the new era. You write, you blog, and you get as visual as you can. Readers want pictures, they want video, and you need the skills to bring that to the mix. Okay, day two in Sarasota, after a complimentary breakfast buffet at the Hilton, thank you very much, it was off to the Ringling Arts Festival. Now, we all think of Ringling just as the circus guy. He teamed up with Barnum and Bailey, and the rest is history. But down in Sarasota, he was the man. Not only did he run his circus down there, but he built an art museum. He was a huge art collector and needed a place, George Carlinically speaking, for his stuff. John Ringling and his wife Mabel also had a little house down there, which is so gorgeous. You just want to tear your eyes out, because 99% of anything else you will ever stare at in your lifetime is not going to look so beautiful. More on that in a few. So, before starting with the theater stuff, we had lunch at the Treviso restaurant, which is right in the main center of the Ringling compound, and then I had a couple of hours to wander off on my own and really look around. So, first I went to the art museum, and you would figure someone who started a circus would have been very big on collecting, oddities and artifacts and stuffed elephants or whatever you have, but not John Ringling. The guy was collecting 16th and 17th century Italian and Flemish art in a big way. In 1931, he opened the museum just to have a place for it all. And since he had the money to do it right, the museum isn't just a glorified warehouse. It's a work of art in itself, while also showing off the collection. We're talking El Greco, Veronese, Titian, or, as I like to say to get a giggle, Titian. And certainly the most famous thing there is the Rubens Room. The guy's got four giant canvases by Peter Paul Rubens, part of a series called The Eucharist, which are Bible scenes that somehow also relate to symbolism of the transubstantiation. Whatever, they're big. And it's impressive, although I tend to OD on medieval and Renaissance art that is relentlessly religious. There are only so many glowing albino Christ childs I can see without saying, okay, it's a baby. Can you please just paint something else? Anything! Dogs playing poker with St. Francis. I don't care. Just stow the Mary Magdalenes and the bobble-headed saviors. Oh, and they also painted a lot of saints with arrows going through them. What's with that? I thought it was only Sebastian, but apparently there was a whole boatload of saints dodging the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Makes you wonder whether these guys were oppressed by the Roman army or the Seminole Indians. Anyway, there is some non-biblical art in the Ringling Museum. A few landscapes, plus a small Asian wing with a bunch of Buddhas in it. And just to be perverse, they had a modern artist do completely avant-garde paintings and sprinkle those in here and there amidst all the classical stuff. So there'd be a room full of Dutch masters and classical religious reliefs, and then a big post-Kandinsky smear of gray with black lines and red smudges. And the little signs by the modern paintings went for the usual questions teachers ask kids in a museum. Do you see the connection between that old Velázquez and this new Louise Feldman, or whatever her name was? And I'm like, no, No, I do not see the connection between Velázquez and Louis Feldman. The Velázquez is some well-dressed nobleman standing by a bowl of fruit. The Feldman is a green splotch with black and pink squiggles. I'm sorry, there is no connection. I don't mind juxtaposing modern art with old, but there should be some interdynamic. I mean, I can also bring a box of dead frogs and put it next to a Turner painting and go, let's look for artistic similarities. No, let's not. But I did enjoy the museum as well as the other museum on the same grounds, the Tibbles, which is devoted entirely to a miniature representation of the circus. It's quite a feat of labor and painstaking detail because everything is model size. You go into this tent, and they've got the circus music playing and the pre-recorded crowd noise. On the wall, you can read the timeline of circuses, how they evolved over the last two centuries, alongside what else was going on in the world at the same time. I love that kind of stuff. But the Tibbles Museum is really about walking around and around this diorama, which takes you from the loading in of all the equipment and the performers and the animals up through the sideshows and the midway, and literally thousands of figurines of clowns and acrobats and dancers. If you like model trains and that kind of thing, the Tibbles Museum will make you change your underpants. If, like me, you really couldn't give a rat's left nut about figurines, well, it's impressive and fun for about 10 minutes. I stayed for 15 and was then off to the Taj Mahal, which should just be renamed the Taj Mahal West. It isn't that grand or ornate, but as mansions go, it's a mansion. It cost $1.5 million to build back in 1925, done in Venetian mixed with Gothic style, and every room is like a museum, let alone the palatial outside. And then, the backyard is Sarasota Bay. So, think of this. Every morning, Mabel Ringling would wake up, putter around the kitchen, grab a newspaper, and look out on heaven. Did I mention I hate the rich? And speaking of wealthy, the next day I also got over to the Antique Car Museum. It's right across the street from Ringling, but not part of that whole complex. Pretty neat place, although for $8.50 adult admission, I kind of wanted, well, more cars. Maybe a video, something interactive. Instead, it's just a giant garage with cars going back to the 1910s. And it's amazing how every vehicle appears huge when you put it in a museum. You can take a two-door VW Beetle. If you shine it up, put a spotlight on it, it looks like a monster truck. And again, I'm not an auto enthusiast. I care about old cars only slightly more than I care about tiny plastic clowns. But when you personalize the car, that's when it gets interesting. So, at the Sarasota Classic Car Museum, they had, I think it was a Chevy from the 1980s. No big deal, except that Chevy was owned by Katharine Hepburn. I don't know why that makes a difference, but it does. She didn't even drive it. She had a driver. Thank goodness, because at that point, Hepburn was probably shaking like a willow tree every time she tried to signal. But ownership does make the car more special. I mean, they had Ferraris and Bentleys and a bunch of Italian cars. They had a DeLorean. Now, I didn't realize those were unpainted, ugly things, actually. They were the basic gray metal alloy that the car came in to begin with. I guess that was best for sniffing cocaine off of. But the best was the Beetles. Not the VW Beetles I mentioned. I've seen tons of those. But the museum has on display four cars directly associated with the Fab Four. First, they had the big Bentley, which I think was parked outside Apple Studios and painted by the same guy who designed Yellow Submarine. I could be fudging the details here, but the car is for real, painted all psychedelically and really giving you a feeling for that crazy, amazing time. Even cooler, they had two cars owned by Paul McCartney, including this small blue coupe that all the Beatles got when Brian Epstein was first pushing them to the big time. And most of all, a nice, fairly large, somewhat nondescript automobile, which is described as the last car John Lennon owned. Extraordinary how Just a small piece of information like that takes you right back and hits you in a place you didn't expect.
Ask the girl what she wanted to be. She said, baby, can't you see? I want to be famous, a star on the screen. But you can do something in between. Maybe you can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a star. Maybe you can drive my car. And maybe I love you. I told that girl that my prospects were good. And she said, baby, it's understood. Working for peanuts is all very fine. But I can show you a better time. Baby, you can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a star. Baby, you can drive my car. And maybe I love you. Beep, 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 yeah.
Actually, my second favorite thing at the Classic Car Museum wasn't a car at all, but a poster listing about 24 brief poems. These were the Burma Shave ads, the world-famous ads that a shaving cream company put up on roadsides. You know the story. There'd be nothing on the roads and highways for miles around, and suddenly, a homemade-looking sign. And the sign would have the first line of a short poem. Then, 100 yards down the road, the next line. Then the next. The fourth line, which would usually have some witty, slightly naughty kicker, all based around the idea of shaving making men more attractive and appealing to the fairer sex. And it was just great to see these really clever ditties lined up and posted like that in one place. So here's a couple I grabbed off Wikipedia. Train approaching, whistle squealing, stop, avoid that run-down feeling, Burma shave. Riot at drugstore, calling all cars, 100 customers, 99 jars, Burma shave. Don't take a curve at 60 per, we hate to lose a customer, Burma shave. A peach looks good with lots of fuzz, but man's no peach and never was, Burma shave. Don't stick your elbow out so far, it might go home in another car, Burma shave. Just love these. And imagine that you're driving hundreds of miles on the open road. A little chuckle like that keeps you going to the next rest stop or trailer park. My job is keeping faces clean, and nobody knows the stubble I've seen. Burma shave. Okay, last one. Ben met Anna, made a hit. Neglected beard, Ben Anna split. Burma shave. All right, I can't go out on that one. How about this? The wolf is shaved, so neat and trim. Red Riding Hood is chasing him. Burma shave. You can understand why the writer in me found that poster one of the highlights of the whole trip.
And when they pulled her from the wreck, you know she still had on a shave. They say the trees are growing wild just this side of Burma.
After the car museum, I also got to see the Sarasota Jungle Gardens. Didn't have a lot of time there, but it's a great place to see birds, owls, eagles, parrots, toucans, and this thing in the toucan family called an arikari that has a serrated beak and a longer tail. And what's nice about the Jungle Gardens is not only its lush, foresty kind of setup, but also 85% of its animals are rescues, either from abusive conditions or places where they're threatened with extinction. And the best part is their famous pink flamingos. They're free, they're loose, they walk around in packs, and you get up close as you please to take a picture. You can feed them by hand or just stroll along with them. It's a little pricey to get into the Jungle Gardens, but I guess you're paying for species preservation as well as the actual grounds and upkeep. And speaking of species, my one other side trip was to the Moat Aquarium. It's not the greatest of aquariums. Aquarii, the age of Aquarius. Anyway, for Florida, I kind of expected something bigger and snazzier, but then again, with SeaWorld a couple of hours away, it's no surprise that other show places for fish aren't quite so elaborate. So Moat Aquarium is pretty typical. It's got the shark tank and the saltwater fish and the Finding Nemo types. And yes, they've got a pair of manatees. Yay. Love those fellas. Something about those so-called gentle giants of the sea. My wife and I have loved manatees ever since, believe it or not, Dr. Katz, M.D. I wasn't particularly aware of manatees until this cartoon show on Comedy Central, Dr. Katz, Professional Therapist. You probably remember it because it was almost unwatchable. The drawing, I mean. It was done intentionally in squiggle vision. So it was all these jumpy, squiggly lines, and you were grateful for commercials because you couldn't watch more than 6 minutes without getting a headache. I'm amazed they didn't take stills from the show and hang them next to El Greco in the Ringling Museum. But seriously, Dr. Katz could be a pretty funny program. Jonathan Katz was the actual actor playing this very low-key psychotherapist. I mean, he makes Stephen Wright sound like Billy Mays. So Katz was playing this laid-back shrink conducting group therapy. And one of the patients goes on a riff about vacations and postcards, and how he once got a postcard from Florida with a manatee on it, which led to a discourse on sea cows, and how manatees are really underappreciated, how even the term sea cow is something of an insult. Cut to a manatee defending itself on the Ricky Lake show, audience members yelling at him, telling him he's fat and he should get a job, and he's like, I'm a manatee, I live in the ocean. It was a very funny bit, and he was really cute. And it was one of those things where, when you're dating, and you share something cute together, it takes on a life and mystique beyond its actual value. So my wife and I were dating at the time, or newly married, and this hysterical bit comes on, and of course we bond over how cute manatees are. And since then, whenever we go to aquariums, or to SeaWorld, we look for the manatees. So yes, there are two very cute manatees at Moat Aquarium, eating their lettuce, bumping up against the glass. Be advised, they're not on camera on the internet. The famous manatee cam is actually from another facility in Homosassa, Florida, and not to be confused with Conan O'Brien's horny manatee, which turns out is less horny than David Letterman. But okay, two manatees at Moat, you get your money's worth. And they also have another bird sanctuary, like in the jungle gardens, kind of tucked away from the aquarium proper. But this, too, has a bunch of birds with physical disabilities and rescue situations. So you'll see a stork with a plunger for a foot, parrots with neoprene beaks, toucans with just one can, or worse, toucans who can't. And it's a great thing. They're learning about birds while also helping creatures that would be vulture bait in the wild. But I have to say, I was disappointed. When you get to Moat Aquarium, the one big thing they're advertising, and you see it in the signs, they are so proud of this. Come see the giant squid. Like something out of Jules Verne. Come see the giant squid. So this is exciting. I'm like, show me, where's the squid? And what they don't tell you, what they should put on the signs, even if it's in little tiny letters between the words giant and squid, is that their giant squid is dead. It's been dead for years. Now, granted, I guess it's a little tougher to market an aquarium exhibit by saying, come see the giant dead squid. It's like advertising next Thursday at the Highline Ballroom, Bruce Springsteen impersonator. I mean, it's not quite truthful advertising. So yes, the Moat Aquarium does have a giant squid. It's also white, flat, and lifeless. Apparently it's nearly impossible to capture a live giant squid, which makes me wonder what the hell they're putting on my plate when I order calamari, but any aquarium that does boast an enormous squid has only a post-mortem one, because they're notoriously difficult to even photograph, let alone catch. Moat Aquarium has Molly the Mollusk, 27 feet long, or at least she was when captured. Well, not captured, she floated up to the surface dead and they scooped her out. And like old women in nursing homes, dead squid lose height and mass in captivity. So Molly is nearly a foot smaller than she was when they first packed her in formaldehyde. But at least she was floating in cool, gooey gel while the rest of us were walking around in the blazing Florida heat. But I am not complaining. I had a terrific time in Florida. I loved seeing the flora, the fauna, the water, the lushness of everything, and the theater. That's what I was really there for. I saw 5 shows in 2 days, including a new work by Downtown Darling's Elevator Repair Service and a touring show by legendary director Peter Brook. But we'll save all that for the Inside Broadway segment of Days Gone By. That's where we talk about news and gossip on the Great White Way, and also sometimes go far afield for reviews and critiques of theater wherever I happen to see it. So stay tuned for Inside Broadway and more of this torrid and florid episode of Dave's Gone By. Don't go away. Everything old is new again, because now you can hear vintage episodes of Dave's Gone By 2 different ways. At davesgoneby.org, click the links to hear entire episodes free anytime, day or night. But maybe you want something more tangible. You can still buy shows on CD for just $10, postage included. Visit davesgoneby.org for all your CD and podcast needs, or email davesgoneby@aol.com. We'll make everything old new again.
We'll order now what they ordered then, 'cause everything old is new again.
Inside Broadway, brought to you by Performing Arts Insider and TotalTheater.com.
Yes, we go inside Broadway for news of the theater. Now, I know most of this Dave's Gone By episode is taken up with my trip to Florida, but that doesn't mean I can't tell you what's going on the stages of New York. Well, the big opening this past week was on Broadway, Hello Birdie. Bye Bye Birdie opened October 15th at the newly renovated Henry Miller's Theater. The Roundabout Theater Company, that big octopus now in New York, took the Miller's Theater over a few years ago and promised to renovate it and turn back into a legitimate theater, and they've done it. And their first show is a revival of a musical that hasn't been on Broadway in decades, Bye Bye Birdie. And, despite reviews castigating everyone in the cast, pretty much, from John Stamos to Gina Gershon to even Bill Irwin, Bye Bye Birdie is selling very, very well. They were, last I checked, selling 100% capacity during previews, and even after bad reviews came out on opening night, they announced, hey, we've got tickets on sale through at least April of 2010. The reviews, however, well, Linda Weiner of Newsday said, there's no reason to put on a happy face. And Terry Teachout of the Wall Street Journal put it this way, John Stamos couldn't carry a tune in a bucket with the lid welded on. Oof. And Bill Irwin can't sing at all. Instead, he emits disjunct honks and squeaks that make mincemeat out of Charles Strauss's handsome melodies. Ow, 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 ow. But I don't know. When I get reviews like these, especially for a revival of a fairly well-liked, if not loved, musical, I get the feeling audiences are having a better time of it than the reviewers are. I'm hoping to see the show next week in New York, so I'll report on that back to you on the next episode of Dave's Gone By. Also receiving good news box office-wise, ticket-wise, the Manhattan Theater Club and their Broadway house, the Samuel J. Friedman Theater, they've been doing a revival of the show called The Royal Family. Well, sticking around a couple of extra weeks. It opened on October 8th, and they've just announced that they're extending to December 13th. So, again, I'm hoping to catch that, too, when I'm in New York, and I'll let you know whether the royal family is a clan worth visiting. Now, God of Carnage, this is a show that got wonderful reviews when it opened, probably reviews even beyond what it deserved, and is also a huge audience draw. It's one of the hottest selling shows on Broadway since it opened last season. But, well, they've got a pretty well-known and high-level cast, and they're not going to stick around forever. As a matter of fact, November 17th is the last chance that you have to catch the original cast of God of Carnage. Marcia Gay Harden, Jeff Daniels, James Gandolfini, and Hope Davis. They're all going away. But the show is not going away. You don't kill a cash cow like this. So, they picked a rather odd assortment, seemingly, to make up the new cast of this Yasmina Reza comedy, including Jimmy Smits of NYPD Blue fame, Annie Potts, whom you'll remember from Designing Women, Ken Stott, and the Heidi Chronicles' own Christine Lottie. I'm still trying to think who's going to play whom in this comedy. You know, it's about these two couples where one of their children has beaten up the other child a little bit in the playground, and now they're trying to decide civilly how to punish the child. And of course, the parents end up becoming more crazy and immature than the children ever were. It's a pretty cute and fun play, so be interesting how this new cast takes it on starting in mid-November. Well, that's the news of Broadway. Now I'm going to go back to Florida for all the shows that I caught at the Sarasota Ringling Arts Festival, and plus a little show I caught at a dinner theater there that's been a Florida institution for almost four decades on Inside Broadway. But first, got to do a little business and thank the people who bring us Inside Broadway every week, Performing Arts Insider.
The best Broadway magazine just got better. More listings, more contact numbers, more inside information in Performing Arts Insider. And not just Broadway, off-Broadway, off-off, dance, cabaret, opera. As one dramaturg put it, Performing Arts Insider is a goldmine of information for the theater professional. 21 times a year at your doorstep, the whole world of theater, with 10% off for Dave's Gone By listeners. Visit PerformingArtsInsider.com or call 516-295-1511. 516-295-1511. Performing Arts Insider. It's Broadway the best way.
Welcome back to Inside Broadway, and we go all the way off Broadway now to Southwest Florida, to Sarasota, where just 2 weeks ago we had the Ringling Arts Festival, their first ever, and they may even make it biannual if, you know, the tickets sold enough and there was enough interest. Now, the festival itself is put together as a combination of a deal between the Ringling Arts Museum that I mentioned before and the Baryshnikov Arts Center in New York, which is not this long-standing, very staid classical institution in the city at all. It's there for sort of new and avant-garde and cutting-edge works. And it is very much allied with the dancer, former dancer, Mikhail Baryshnikov, who was there at the Ringling Festival. So there was just a little bit of star-quality glamour there as you were hopping around the VIP lounge and seeing him coming to the shows as well. And it also meant that half the productions at the Arts Festival were dance. Since I'm not a dance critic, I did not have the time or really much of the effort to go see the dance pieces. I heard they were interesting. I heard there was a terrific flamenco performance and an interesting, if extremely grim, somewhat political performance by an Israeli dance artist, and a couple of other things. Wish I'd had the time to see them, but I was concentrating on the theater, including being able to see a couple of one-act plays put on by writers at the FSU MFA writing program. FSU, Florida State University, and their master's students. So you got to see, hear the plays that were written by the kids in that program, acted also by students in the acting program at Florida State University. So it was nice to see, and they did it outside in a tent with some air conditioning units all around, so we weren't dying completely. Although, honest to God, it's great to see plays outside. It's really sort of a really nice open feeling. But if you're in Florida, every other second you are swatting gnats off your sweating body. So it can make it a little bit hard to concentrate on great literature if your hands are just going all over you. But it wasn't exactly great literature that was going on from the FSU students. I mean, there's some promising work there, but can't say there was anything really worth seeing of those short plays. The first one was called Too Long at the Fair, which was a cute idea about a girl acting at a Renaissance fair, and she's torn between these two guys, one of whom is her director, and the other is an actor in the fair who takes the whole Renaissance thing a little too seriously and really can't ever get out of character. Or at least that's what the premise is, except he does go in and out of character, so that's not very clear. And they make kind of a cutesy story of it, but sorry, just didn't really work. There was a better setup for the second one act play called The Wilderness, and it's all about, actually a very good premise. There's a guy who does videos at home, and he's become sort of an internet YouTube star for doing these wine critiques and how to mix drinks and foods and stuff like that. Well, he gets a visit out of the blue from an old friend who's like this good-looking, charming fella who's now running for somewhat important political office. Well, the fella has found out that his old friend is now kind of a video YouTube star, so he wants him to do a video of him saying what a wonderful politician he would be, blah, blah, blah. But of course, there's some old business between them and some not pleasantness. And they have an argument, and then there's this jockeying about of whether they'll do the video or how it will come out. It's a good idea. Unfortunately, because this is a 10-minute play showcase, there's really not enough time to develop it. So it starts fairly abruptly, it gets going too quickly, and then you kind of know what's going to happen at the denouement. So, I don't know, I would kind of work on this and expand it to maybe a half-hour play, and maybe you'd have something there. And then the last of the quick one-act plays that they were doing was something called Previously On, which again had such a premise that's almost too much to believe. It takes place at an audition for a TV commercial. So an acting teacher, a veteran actor, is there preparing and wanting to do well. But also a young woman is there going for the same role because it's just a voiceover. And turns out, well, they were ex-boyfriend and girlfriend and things didn't end happily between them, and now she's been dating his son. Again, quite a coincidence to base a play on, and just their banter back and forth, kind of interesting, pretty well acted, but just not really buying it, and between the heat and the gnats, the scripts were just short enough for me at the Festival Cafe. But then it was on to the major works at the festival, and a great improvement right off the bat with a show called The Eight, which is also kind of small scale. It's monologues for eight different characters, English characters. The play was written by a British playwright, Ella Hickson. And within 2 or 3 minutes, you can tell that she has talent and a very particular voice, even when she's writing for all these other people's voices. So my only disappointment with The Eight is that it isn't as promised. They don't do all eight monologues. What they've done at the festival was do four of them, because they don't want shows there to last much more than an hour. And then I guess if they went back another time and caught a different performance, there would have been the four other monologues that you missed. But the four that they did were very well worth seeing. The first sequence has an English hooker, a very cheery Mary Poppins kind of woman for men who want to pop off, and it takes a very funny and penetrating look at the way a certain type of English man is at sea in the post-feminist, post-celebrity paparazzi world. It resents that stupidity and the Simon Cowling of Britain. And again, it's the details that writer Ella Hickson puts in, like the prostitute whose mother was also a hooker. She remembers the sound of men's shoes on the carpet in the other room when she was young. Little things like that. And then that first piece was quite funny. The second character is not so amusing. He's a man who grew up working at his mom's funeral home and also hasn't really gotten over the fact that his father died fighting in Kuwait. So, again, little things here and there, the lines of dialogue, like he works out a lot and keeps his body in shape. Why? Because, quote, my body was proof of the size of my balls. Well, tells you something about that character right then and there. And it's kind of a dark scene, but also a tender one, surprisingly. Now, the third sequence goes back to pretty funny and also quite touching. It's a Welsh woman 3 weeks before Christmas, and she's got a tough time with everything going on in her life and scraping by with the little money she has, and then she's lucky enough to experience the real spirit of the holiday season. It's a postmodern Christmas carol kind of thing. A little hard to understand because of the actress's strong and believable accent, but you have to really pay attention to it. And then the final scene, darkest of all, really, is about a young woman who was molested very young as a child, and her mom did seemingly the right thing, where after that, she took all the doors out of the house. No doors on the bedrooms, on the bathrooms, on the closet. There's absolutely no space where anything secret or bad could happen. But of course, that steals all the secrets from this young child growing up. And so when she does meet an exciting man, a young man kind of her age, something happens not very nice. Also kind of confusing in the ending there. We're kind of wondering what happens to her. But like all the other pieces that we saw of the eight, it's a good piece with strong characters, strong dialogue. I have to say it was done in the Oslo, the historic Oslo Theater on the grounds of Ringling, and the theater is a little too big and spread out for that kind of piece. It would have been more effective in a smaller theater. But effective as it was kind of impressive. So remember the name Ella Hickson, and all the actors in the show, not shabby either, I have to say. Now, what everybody who came to the Ringling Arts Festival for the theater was most excited about and looking forward to see was something called Elevator Repair Service. This is a group that's been around for a few years in New York and downtown in Brooklyn, doing mostly stuff where they're adapting texts from novels and poems and things like that, and trying to turn them into theater in an interesting way. It isn't just that they're doing plays or writing new plays. They're really glomming their texts and their dialogues from other sources and cobbling it together. Now, among the shows that they've done before are Room Tone, based on texts by psychologist William James and his brother, Henry James. There was a mix of Jack Kerouac and William F. Buckley in their show No Great Society. They turned Euripides into postmodern tragic farce in Highway to Tomorrow, and they also did a staging of William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury. So this time, at the festival, they were doing a workshop of The Sun Also Rises, the Ernest Hemingway novel. So we're not really supposed to review it, so I can't, but I will say that some of it is really theatrical and kind of exciting. But since it's a workshop, there is a lot of work to be done. What they have not yet found was the drama in it. It's storytelling, and it's scene after scene after scene, and some of the scenes are just basically narrated and not really done more than that, with just some people speaking the dialogue. And some scenes, as I said, are really tremendously exciting. There's a bullfighting sequence and a dance sequence, but they just haven't found, and I don't imagine the novel is that dramatic either. I haven't read it, but a lot of the characters are really passive, and it's very tough to make theater out of passive characters. So I wish them well. It's definitely worth working on, but I'd like to see where they go with it. And I will say also that the real story here is an Australian actress named Lucy Taylor, who's been with the company a couple of years, and she is flawless. She plays the femme fatale in The Sun Also Rises, and she's glamorous, she's sexy, she's shadowed, she's desperate, she's sad. Watch this actress, Lucy Taylor. If she isn't on Broadway in something in 3 years, I'll, well, Now, who knows what Broadway minds and economics do, but she is definitely a find. Now they just have to find the story of The Sun Also Rises.
Brush up your Shakespeare. Start quoting him now. Brush up your Shakespeare, and no women you will wow.
Just declaim a few lines from Othello, and they'll think you're a hell of a fella.
If your blonde won't respond when you flatter her, tell her what Tony told Cleopatra.
If she bites when her clothes you are mussing,
what have clothes much ado about nothing? Brush up your Shakespeare, and they'll all bow, bow.
One of the other hot tickets at the Ringling Arts Festival was the new show by legendary director Peter Brook. That name, I mean, goes back to his famous book about directing for theater and also his Midsummer Night's Dream, which stripped away all the Renaissance-y and the costumes and stuff and just did it in like a blank white space and really turned the theater world upside down at that point in the way that people were doing classic theater. But he's been stripping things away in the way for many, many years now, and he's still doing it. So his new show is called Love Is My Sin, and all it is 30 Shakespearean sonnets. That's it. He's got two actors doing the Shakespearean sonnets, talking them to each other and to us in the audience. Doesn't claim to be anything more than that. I mean, there's a couple of black chairs and pine wooden chairs and a Persian rug. And I have to say, I have a little bit of background on this because I was once in a show on Long Island where the main show was special occasions of comedy drama by Bernard Slade. And I wasn't in that part of the show, which was about these two people who were once lovers, and then they get back together and not really back together. Well, in between the scenes, it was the director's idea to have two people come out and each do a Shakespearean sonnet. And the sonnets would comment on the scenes that just took place or were about to take place. Good idea, although it kind of got a little long towards the end. I mean, it turned a two-hour show into 2.5 hours, and Shakespeare's sonnets are not exactly action-packed. They're just good to hear, and they're brilliant, of course. So imagine 30 of them, one after another, after another, after another. You know, especially in the early part of the show, you kind of got to get the toothpicks going in your eyelids. But Peter Brook, I'll give him this. He does find the shapes of these things, not only within the poems themselves, but creating this kind of dynamic of this man and the woman where it's a battle of the sexes, they come together, then they're pulled apart by jealousy and disappointment and emotional wounding, confessions and death, and then they swing back together at certain points when there's more love and attraction and excitement. So they circle around the chairs, they move upstage and downstage and away from each other, and the body language is very effective. We know from their stances, let alone their many, many words, just what these two people are feeling about each other in a given poem. Made me think in some ways of Edward Albee's marriage plays, even though, really, there's no changes made. They're just doing the poems verbatim. And so I'll give this to Peter Brook. I'm not saying I can recommend the show for any great night at the theater, but where Elevator Repair Service is still trying to find the story in a lot of incidents, Peter Brook does a pretty good job of finding the story where there is no story. Kind of interesting. Now, one last show that I made sure to see while I was in Florida, just because I was curious, was at the Golden Apple Dinner Theater. They've been spending the last 38 years entertaining people on Southwest Florida. Now they're in a kind of cool building on North Pineapple Avenue. They weren't always there. And it's a family-run business by the Turoffs. You know, children are now starting to run it, but Kyle is still there. He made the pre-curtain speech before the show. And I also wanted to see the production they're doing. It's called Run for Your Wife, which is a farce by Ray Cooney. I'm like the guy in Send in the Clowns. I do love farce. I think it's a very tough thing to write. I appreciate the craft that goes into it, especially when it works and makes me laugh. And I saw Run for Your Wife 20 years ago on Broadway with the author in it, Ray Cooney, who is pretty funny, and with Paxton Whitehead, who had me literally crying in my seat with laughter and holding my sides. And it was just, you know, if the farce was, let's say, a B-plus farce, he turned it into an A-plus every time he was on the stage, and he's on the stage quite a lot. Well, this mounting of Run For Your Wife at the Golden Apple Dinner Theater doesn't really even approach that level of comedy. Kind of tough to do that. First of all, we're not talking about Broadway-level budget or Broadway-level people, and also, to do a farce like this really, really right, you should probably rehearse it for about a month, and then do it for another month in front of audiences to really get the timing down. Well, I saw it on the second night in front of an audience. So there's only so much you can do. If something is just a millisecond off, the laugh is ha-ha instead of ha-ha-ha-ha. And, you know, still at all, I was glad to see it. It's an amusing play. It's pretty well done. And they have one actor in there, Cliff Rolls, who is an actual Englishman. And he has that funniest part in the show, but he does make the most of it. The other people, pretty good, although I can understand why some of my other critic friends in Florida were a little reticent about seeing it or even thinking good things about the play. There is a gay character who was probably offensive 20 years ago, but I didn't notice it or realize it. Now I notice it and realize it. It's a really stereotypical gay character, which I'm sure you can play a lot of different ways, but the actor they have doing it just dives headlong into the stereotype, and it's not nearly as funny as it could be if he just played it like a more straight human being instead of something out of, oh my gosh, I don't even, beyond Benny Hill type posing. Still and all, what I like about Golden Apple is they're doing this piece because I think Ray Cooney gets way too short shrift as a playwright. And not only that, in repertory, they're doing the play that Ray Cooney wrote 15 years after Run For Your Wife. They're doing the sequel. It's called Caught in the Net. So you get to see the same people, the same characters, and then watch them in the sequel to the play. And I think that's a great idea. So is this the ideal Run For Your Wife? No, that was 20 years ago on Broadway. But it's creditable and credible, and anybody out there doing farce, even half decently, gets a hand from me, whether you're outside or inside Broadway. We've just been inside Broadway, thanks to TogleTheater.com and Performing Arts Insider.
Oh, honey, make sweet love to me.
Huh?
Can't you put down that stupid book?
In a minute, dear.
You said that 20 minutes ago. What's so special about marriage, babies, and the end of the world?
Well, it's a collection of plays by radio host Dave Lefkowitz.
Why do you want to read a bunch of plays?
Because they're hilarious.
How'd you even buy that book?
Online at davesgoneby.org. $20. And they've got trade paperbacks for $12.
You would rather read Marriage, Babies, and the End of the World than ride me like a hot stallion?
Well, maybe we can compromise. Wow, I love this book! Oh, and you too, hon.
World Weird Web, 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 World...
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. Time for a segment that we haven't done in a long time, but I do enjoy it. Just going on the internet, the World Weird Web, as we call it, and finding a couple of places that might be fun to surf when you're not busy downloading porn or illegal music or trying to change your college grades without the professors knowing. Well, first of all, we mentioned earlier in the show hornymanatee.com, the Conan O'Brien segment that started as a little goof, and then because they mentioned the website hornymanatee.com on the air, which at that point didn't exist, NBC had to go and buy it. Because otherwise, if someone else had bought it and put, you know, naughty things on there, NBC would have been legally responsible if some kid had surfed onto it and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, they spent a couple of $100 and bought hornymanatee.com. This is about 3.5 years ago. And the great thing is they kept it up. So you can still see all the old pictures of the horny manatee in action, plus tons of fan art, drawings, and digital pictures that people have done, most of them involving Conan O'Brien doing things with or to the horny manatee. It's not going to be really X-rated comic fun stuff, but it's just the whole idea of it is so ridiculous and fun. And that the idea, so many years later, people are still grooving on it and getting a kick out of it and some laughs, I think is really great. So support hornymanatee.com. Go there, surf, do your own fan art, and keep the manatee sexually in our minds. But the other thing I wanted to tell you on this edition of the World Weird Web was going to sleep last night, flipping channels. The Yankees had just won the second game of the ACLS playoffs, and flipped through, and it was a Saturday night, so I saw a commercial that for a moment I assumed was part of Saturday Night Live, a spoof. But then I realized it was not on the right channel, it wasn't even at the right time for it. It was a late night commercial about a website about President Barack Obama done as a chia. It's a chia Obama, ladies and gentlemen. You get to watch the bristly green hair grow on the president's head. Now, I didn't realize this already goes back a few months. In April, Walgreens in Chicago and Tampa banned the chia Obama product, but then CBS picked it up, and now I guess they're going national with TV commercials. And a chia Obama can be yours for the amazingly low price of $19.99 plus shipping. When all the problems were going on with the idea that, oh well, this might possibly be a slightly racist artifact, the founder of the chia company told the Daily News, since when is an Afro racist? Especially since you can trim the chia's hair to any length you want. Which brings up the prospect of Barack Obama with a mullet. Words cannot describe. But go to chiaobama.com. They have the product. If you want to buy it, you know, makes a marvelous Hanukkah gift. And also, you can see the whole one-minute commercial there. And the way they do it, like, it opens almost like a presidential election commercial, where the candidate is running and they're doing his slogans, and then, bam, there's this brown chia object, and you see the hair sprout on Barack Obama's head and turn a beautiful shade of green. It is hysterically funny, if I do say so myself. ChiaObama.com. I'm afraid I don't have any such thing as a Chia Dave, where I could finally get some hair growing back on my head, whatever color it might be. But I do have my own website. It's called davesgoneby.org. It tells you tons of stuff about this program. You can see photos of me and links to all the guests who have appeared on the program, and also all the old episodes free to listen to anytime. davesgoneby.org. And unlike the chia, you don't have to mow it. We'll be right back.
If you're a good American, that means you like to own things. Well, now's your chance. You can own a piece of my show. That's right. Dave's Gone By is ready to promote you. If you have a product, event, or service to hawk shamelessly, you can buy 30 or 60 seconds of advertising time on my show. You can even be a sponsor. Just imagine. This week's News Gone By is brought to you by you. We'll be right back after this word from your product. Advertising on Dave's Gone By is cost-effective and reaches listeners on the web all over the world. To get a piece of the Dave, call 516-295-1511 or email davesgoneby@aol.com. To see our disgustingly low ad rates, check our website, davesgoneby.org. Remember, you could be talking to you right now. Are you listening?
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By and this special travelogue edition of the show, but it is time to leave both Florida and the neighborhood for this week. Just want to let you know that if you like the show or don't like the show or anything in between and you want to tell me, please write to me at davesgoneby@aol.com. That's Dave, like my name, davesgoneby@aol.com. And of course, I've got to thank the sponsors of this program: Hewlett Minuteman Press, the copy kings of Broadway; Fancy Schmancy Balloons for the best possible parties; Performing Arts Insider Theater Magazine, the Bible of Broadway since 1944; and also TotalTheater.com. It's a place where you can read hundreds and hundreds of theater reviews and feature stories from around the world. TotalTheater.com. Also, I want to remind you that Rabbi Sol Solomon's program, Shalom Dammit, is still on YouTube. You can watch it. You can see it over and over again. The episodes are carved up, but they're all there, all 10 episodes of Shalom Dammit on YouTube. Just look for Rabbi Sol Solomon or Shalom Dammit. Time for some shout-outs. Hello to Jeff Goodman. Hope to get him back on the air here real soon. Also, want to tell you about a bunch of folks who have been on the program as guests and are now playing all over New York, including Maud Maggart, who's going to be at Feinstein's November 10th through the 14th with her show Parents and Children. Also, Wing is back at Birdland, yay, October 25th through the 26th, and she'll be joined by the cast of Hair on Broadway. Go to birdlandjazz.com to find out more. Now, at Joe's Pub, a whole bunch of our people, including Uta Lemper, who will be there December 10th through the 13th, and the beloved Issa, just added to Joe's Pub, December 11th through the 12th. And Jeremy Schoenfeld is going to be there, a couple days from now, October 26th. Linda Etter will be at Town Hall October 16th through the 18th. And last but not least, Chris Smither and the Motivators come into Joe's Pub November 15th. Remember to go to joespub.com for all the information on that. As far as thank yous go, I have a whole bunch of them. Of course, my mom and dad Lefkowitz. I'm looking forward to seeing them next week when I'm back in New York. Also, Mama and Papa Weil. Very much looking forward to seeing them in Colorado in a few days. Also, my incredibly hardworking and beautiful and wonderful wife, Joyce. Thank her for everything. Shout-outs to Lamar and to Jessica in the VIP lounge. And, of course, to Aaron and Dave and all the great folks at MMG Marketing, who really treated us like gold when we were in Florida, as well as the kind staff at the Ringling Center and my colleagues on the trip, a really cool group. Well, it is time to leave the neighborhood, but we'll be back very soon for the 319th episode of Dave's Gone By. Until then, don't miss your days going by. This is Dave Lefkowitz wishing you a good night, all the Florida keys to the kingdom, and gone by.